sit back, grab a cup of coffee, and explore some of today's most pressing educational issues through the experienced eyes of leading education personalities. Welcome to Coffee. Well, Julie, really what I want to talk with you right now is about this concept that we live in a world where students of all ages have the notion, which is great, that independence that says, I can do it on my own. I mean, I even see that in my own home with my three-year-old son who always tells me, you know, Dad, I can do it on my own. I want to do it on my own. And the internet and technology with regards to libraries is fascinating to me, with that being the foundation or the premise. And I'm wondering just your thoughts on how you look at it, or how, you know, the American Library Association looks at it when we want to provide support for librarians in that space, in a world where students now have the power because of technology to do so much on their own. Yet when I was growing up in the library, that was one of the main reasons, is that I saw the librarian as a resource and a help. I know that they still are. I just am curious as to how you look at that and how you provide support, not only for the librarians, but for the students in that sort of exchange.
It's a good question. The statements that I made very early on was that the internet is a mile wide and an inch deep. There are, as we all know, billions of sources. And I would carry out your question a little further and say not just children doing it on their own, but we also expect adults to do things on their own. And the reality is that there should be an ever continuing exchange of discussion and interaction, not only between software, if we can say that in that way, but also with adults, teachers, librarians, to assist people in an ongoing way in navigating. So it's not only finding the right tool to use, which they're not probably going to do on their own. It's finding out how that tool best works in an environment, and then the language that goes into that tool. And then once they find the content, how to make decisions between and among those resources. So those are four elements that school teachers and librarians and academics deal with all the time. And that's never ending. So yes, we can teach people tools, which cuts our work down by about 25%, although I will tell you tools are constant and they're constantly being refined. So we can absolutely teach people how to make choices among tools, and we can teach people in general the kinds of languages that are behind some of the tools and teach them skills to go with that. But sharing with them ways to choose from among things that will reduce or kind of narrow that pipeline of discovery is an ongoing process. So we are constantly looking for resources that allow us to do that and our roles and responsibilities in that.
Eleni, I would turn to you then in a similar vein, just slightly different path would be, when you're looking at technologies and your background, when you think about how to incorporate them in a way that can support that notion like Julie's talking about, in not just students and children wanting to basically do things on their own, but to be able to develop it so that not only are they a part of the process, but they can also feel that they're in control, even when the conditions have been set up technologically, so that they can experience the library as something that is free-flowing and independent from the learner's perspective and also the educator's perspective.
Yeah, so this is actually speaking really to my heart. So I have spent many, many years at the Graduate School of Education interacting and teaching teachers or teacher students. And also I have spent quite a bit of time at schools with teachers, with librarians. And what I am finding is this, and it could be a little bit extreme, but I want to share it with you and see how it will apply. I find that the biggest challenge that comes with the new age of information and the new shape that information has is how to change our look at the information. It seems that it seems almost hardwired in our brains that you see the print into Word and you rush to read it. without qualifying that printed word at all. And this comes, of course, from many years where we were dealing with information that came in books where some editors had done something about that information. Librarians in the schools that would pick the right book and give it to us. And now we have this amazing resource that is with a very different DNA. So the web is a very different kind of resource. There is a lot of advantages and some, I don't want to call them disadvantages, but some new needs that this resource has created. So there is a lot of information. And there's a lot of user-generated information. And there is some reliable information and some not so reliable information. And there are there's information that is good for one purpose and others for other purposes. So what I find is where I think the librarians are critical in this new age, this new information age, is in helping the students and the adults. I agree with Julie 100% that this is not just only for the students, it's also for the adults, because we are learning now from these resources, in helping them understand how this information is different from what they were used to, and giving them the tools and the training that is needed to change the way they view the information. And because the curation part has always been a critical part of what the library was offering, the curation part needs now the same skill that librarians have been using to be able to help us with the right kind of information, the good quality information. These same skills now need to be transferred to each of us. So it's not, the resource is too big. We cannot manually curate like 1 trillion different resources. And there are 100 million resources added every day. Either we will have to say that, okay, we're gonna ignore the new resources, or I really don't know, or try to figure out a way of who's going to process 100 million new resources every day and kind of try to classify them. So we need to have our favorite shelves, right? So where do I go? What are my basic resources for this topic on science or another topic? The scalable skill, and I believe it is critically the role of the librarians to train students with this skill, is okay, let's look at what makes the information good information. And sometimes it will be the who is behind this information, is it a reliable resource or not? And sometimes it will be, okay, here is a particular user. How do you know if the way that this user is writing, the way that he's putting this information together, is actually something that you want to take seriously or not? You will have to deal with that as well. And nobody can actually teach and train students with these skills other than the librarians that are best positioned to do that with, because they have this skill set. That's what they have been trained to do. So they're best positioned to do that. So I don't know how you feel about that, Jules, but I feel it is this kind of, changing the attitude of students, understanding there's different types of content and that you have to go deeper, not only by saying, okay, here is a good resource, here is Britannica, that's a good resource, but here is this particular individual, check him out, how is he writing, is he citing, when he's analyzing a topic, how is he analyzing? These skills gradually needs to become our own skills for every student.
Absolutely. Let me make a couple of comments there. You added in a layer of what we deal with all the time, and that is not only the number of items that are added each day, or the number of, and I'll just say items rather than resources, but the incredible number of content or pieces of content that people are putting out there. We have no clue as to their credibility. And I don't know if I told Rod this little anecdote the first time, but I can remember doing a reference interview with someone, and their assignment was secondhand smoke and the effects of secondhand smoke. And here I was helping this student, and this student said, "You don't need to help me. I have America Online," and it was a fine resource. But when he pulled his content up, he said, "This is all I need." And I said, "Let's take a look at this resource." And when we looked at it, the URL or the address of the resource was .ca. And I said, "Son, that's Canada. So it's not the United States." So then he pulled up the next one. And he said, "Well, this is perfect." And I said, "Well, let's look at this. This is a commercial website, and let's see what the effects of secondhand smoke are." And it was a cigarette company. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Let's take a look at this and see what it is." So we went down this list, and that's the kind of thing, that's the expertise that librarians really deal with every day, some of which we can transfer to people to use to apply to everything. But the second thing I would add is that not only what Elaney said, but then you multiply that by the number of disciplines. So the mathematics students have a set of basic critical skills. And then on top of that is the appreciation for not only classic sources, but contemporary assignments. And then you look at geography and realize that classic sources have to be used with contemporary sources, because you can't have something that talks about Russia and the USSR. And as countries morph and change as we move along, and a library or a teacher that's teaching from an old textbook, a librarian that's using an old resource that has an encyclopedia set that still doesn't have the United Arab Emirates in it, or no ICCA stands. We have tons of wonderful countries that have been put together that are new since our encyclopedias were printed. So going back to her first comment, the printed word has always been revered, and when you put that on the screen, there's that continued reverence. But what we have to do is educate people that there is there are so many changes that happen to that printed word when it's put on the screen, and the accessibility and the availability is so great. We've got to apply unique skills to that content.
Julie, when you look at your membership to that point, I'm curious as to what requests they have for their own professional development, or really not even just that, it's just the needs that they have in maintaining that knowledge, at least the base of it. I mean, we're talking about, you know, an inordinate amount of resources and items to both of your points. I'm just curious as to how they communicate that to the ALA, and what they are looking for, and how they can stay abreast. Because, you know, look, the daunting part of it, I think you've both hit on, is that, you know, in theory, if you let a day go by, that's just that many more resources and items that are basically being uploaded to the web, the internet. And we may or may not know what they do, or what they serve, and who and where it's originating, to your point about the student and the tobacco research. So I'm just curious, from the membership, and when you're talking with the librarians, what are they looking for when it comes to building that knowledge, maintaining it, and then also being a part of the process?
The American Library Association is committed to a number of things, but certainly professional development is what associations can and do excel in. And members are constantly queried as to what kind of content they want and need. And the American Association of School Librarians and the Association of College and Research Librarians have the request for information literacy and education probably at the top of their list. But in addition to that, we have an ongoing request for content that assists us in identifying scholarly resources and what is scholarship and resources. And of course, that education piece, as Elaney mentioned, helps you take a look at part of what's delivered in a different way, because if it's identified as scholarly by someone else, that's a step forward. But in addition to that, we have areas that are extremely hot topic, and it's OERs, or Open Educational Resources. Mm-hmm. And these are resources that are created by vetted, very expert people, some of which are free, some of which charge for the platform they're delivered on. And we, and from my impression, we have two different, we have many different kinds of resources, but the two we deal with in my higher ed environment is we deal with textbooks that are OERs, and we have about 28 different resources now in the country or internationally that are open educational resource delivery, sort of jumping off points, I suppose. Call it a diving board. And then we have OERs that are being created by companies who also sell content, but they're aware that some content needs a collaborative focus and some content may need to be free. So open means a number of different things. So librarians are looking at information literacy and open educational resources, scholarly communications. And I don't want to leave out, obviously, special librarians who look at proprietary information and how we can blend OERs with proprietary. And certainly public librarians, and one of the biggest aspects now in publics, and I'm working very closely with a woman, Valerie Gross, I think I mentioned her to you, Rod. She really focuses on the public library as an educational institution. And even though we're not seen that way federally, she talks about the educational role of the public librarian who every single day, every single exchange, needs to add that critical thinking as well.
This concludes part one, How Can We Redefine the American Library? We encourage you to listen to part two as Julie and Eleni continue to discuss the state of American libraries. Join us for our next cup of coffee as we continue to have conversations in education that matter to you. I'm Dr. Rod Berger, and this is Coffee.